So as we're getting towards the end of the quarter, what I want to do tonight is I want to talk a bit about the Bible's strong word about human nature being dependent, being a fancy word that's contingent, limited. We answered that a little bit earlier in the quarter, some of the stuff that we talked about back in, March. A little bit, but I want to, primarily from the Old Testament, a little bit of New Testament as well, but mostly Old Testament, because we find a lot of language in the Old Testament in trying to raise human awareness of just how limited, how small we really are. And you say that's kind of depressing, Joe. I say, yeah, but you know what? You know, when you what happened to every human in the Bible who ever had an experience of God? What happened to them? Yeah, and that was probably the best case scenario. That's exactly right. You know, the Hebrew writer's famous words in Hebrews 12, our God is a consuming fire. And part of, I think, healthy spiritual life is a very clear and strong, and use a Randy Tomlinson word, robust, understanding of who we really are, because that fosters humility as the antidote to what is in some ways kind of the root human sin, a sin that whether it's conscious or not probably leads to all other sins, and it begins with a P and ends with D, well, proud or pride, yeah, that's fair, good point. Still five letters, you will. But anyways, pride. The quintessential human sin. And so I've asked you to turn with me to Daniel chapter 4. Familiar story. King Nebuchadnezzar gets a little big in his britches, gets a big comeuppance. For all the familiarity of the story, you know, set aside the kids' Bible class awareness, which probably were for a lot of us when we first heard this and thought about this, and think about the adult understanding of this, especially its context in the Book of Daniel and the significance of the Book of Daniel beyond the kind of the VBS level Bible stories we kind of derive out of it. Daniel's one of the most important books in the Bible, not just because of the stories, but because of the visions. We don't talk much about the visions. Maybe we need to do a quarter sometime on just 7 through 12, because that's flyover country after chapter 7 for a lot of us, but some really crucial stuff in there. That takes us all the way, not just to the first coming of Jesus, but even into eternity there in chapter 12 a little bit. And so this book represents, in the days of the exile, which is when Daniel lived, kind of a typological, and everybody says what typology is, right? It's kind of like a shadow, a smaller version of the ultimate reality of God, man, sin, salvation, things like that, right? Moses is a type of Christ, because Jesus brings a covenant just like Moses brought a covenant. Moses led his people out of slavery. Christ leads his people out of slavery. Only slavery is now not Pharaoh, it's sin. You with me? Got that kind of an idea. The Bible is full of smaller versions of ultimate realities. And so what Daniel represents, the book itself represents, and this is another class for a whole other quarter, if this doesn't quite make sense or you don't see this immediately, but kind of the adult version of the book of Daniel. It is the ultimate ultimate is not the word I want. It is a almost typological updating. Say again, Randy?
Quintessential.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm a little tired today for that show, so it's been a long weekend. I'll use the thesaurus sitting next to me here to help out. Quintessential, essential. Distillation of the fundamental conflict between God and man. One of the things, in fact, some of you already know this, some of you may have never seen this. We go like literally keep your finger right here, go to chapter 1, and look in verses 1 and 2. When it says that Nebuchadnezzar basically puts Jerusalem into subjugation, raids the temple, takes God's stuff from the temple, and takes God's stuff back to put in the temple of his gods, what's the geographical location? It's interesting, it's not said to be Babylon as such. What's the geographical location? Takes them to the land of Shinar. Now, Eric can't do this because Eric already knows this, I think.
Okay.
So Eric, yeah, you said this all out, Eric. but anybody else, where have you heard the land of Shinar before?
Switzerland.
That's it. Well done.
Cross-reference.
Oh, that's a cheat. But I appreciate your honesty. I appreciate your honesty. The only thing that could have been worse was ChatGPT. No, that's it. No. Yeah, but that's the value of cross-references. What's Genesis chapter 11? Anybody know? What's that story? Tower of Babel. In other words, literally, Babylon of Daniel's day sits in the same land as Tower of Babel. What was Tower of Babel about? Make a name for ourselves. Tower and a name. A story of mankind gathered to build a city and make a name for himself, the city of man in rebellion to the city of God. And so this story, the way it literally opens, little hints like that tell you it's more than just literally something that happened in the 6th century BC, though it is that. It represents an updating of the continual struggle between God and man. Because while Daniel's Jewish, Nebuchadnezzar's not. And Nebuchadnezzar is ruling the greatest city the world has yet seen to that point in his history, right? And so if you come to chapter 4, everybody remembers what Daniel chapter 4 is about. Daniel chapter 4 is when Nebuchadnezzar himself has an encounter with God, because Nebuchadnezzar's got big in his britches about what?
Himself.
Well, himself, but what's the manifestation of himself? The
kingdom.
Greatness of
himself. Yeah, and in particular, he didn't believe names are right there, verse 29. Is this, well, I guess that's after verse 29, it's verse, it is verse 29. Is this not
Babylon?
Look at the city I built, Genesis chapter 11, all over again. Look at the city I built. And by the way, this is free, no extra charge, Hebrew lesson. In Hebrew, in Aramaic for that matter, the name for Babel in Genesis chapter 11 in Hebrew is the exact same word for Babylon in the book of Daniel. Because if you're reading the original, it's all the more clear. This is an update. This is the same old story, same old struggle. And it's always Babylon out there, is what we're being told. And so the quintessential human sin is displayed in the quintessential city of man by the quintessential human ruler when he, in verse 29, says, as he's walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, all verse 30, is this not the great Babel, literally, which I have built by, and pronouns matter, not just on application.
By the might of my power.
Yeah, and we'll keep going though. Look at how many first person pronouns are in this litany.
Glory of my majesty.
Yeah. Yeah, I, me, and my, a lot of I, me, and my in that statement. What's it all about? Pride. The fundamental human sin. What does Satan say to Eve in the garden? You can be like God. Fundamental human sin. All other sins in some ways are downstream. This. To choose sin at all is to choose to make yourself, you know, to set God aside. It's always rooted in pride, whether you realize that or not. And so there it is. And so while the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox. And 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he will. So is did Nebuchadnezzar get the job because he's a great military strategist? Why was he so militarily and politically successful? Because he's so great, wise, and everything else, all the I, me's, and my's? Because God's providence. Now, God may let Nebuchadnezzar run around a bit and do something. He might be a smart guy, but at the end of the day, why? You ever know some smart people who just say, can't seem to get ahead of life? Yeah. It's not just about who's smart and clever and powerful. Sometimes, why am I going to get cancer when you're 25? No matter how smart you were. Who decides you're going to get cancer when you're 25? So there it is. But here's the other thing. Have you ever thought about this? The nature of the judge, could have just struck him dead. Doesn't do that. Could have allowed him to, you know, get a disease. That happens to a Jewish king sometimes. Remember what happens to Asa's feet? Right? You know, God does stuff like that. But the nature of the judgment here, what's the significance of the nature of the judgment that Nebuchadnezzar gets given the nature of the sin that Nebuchadnezzar has committed? It's humiliating.
He's put lower than man. He is made beast.
What's the subtle divine message, do you think, in that kind of a judgment? Where sometimes punishments fit crimes, and punishments themselves are meant to be revelatory about the nature of the sin or the nature of the transgression against God. What's the significance? It's humiliating, certainly, against his pride.
It's a return to creation.
It's a return to creation. And what do we reduce ourselves to without God?
Beasts.
What makes us different than the animals?
God.
Yeah, and our God consciousness. Beasts can't worship. Beasts can't confess. Now, they can bring glory to God by being what they are and to God's joy. But no animal gets scared when it sees an angel. When Balaam's donkey saw the angel, did the donkey get scared? No. Say it. Yeah, he's more scared of Balaam than of the angel, ironically. Yeah, that's right. That's right. But you get the point. Beasts don't recognize God as God the way humans can consciously in worship and confession and humility. You with me? And so this is an ultimate, you know, again, this is a Babel moment. You know, once again, God and man, you have the greatest nation the world has yet seen, so to speak. You have metaphor for Babel all over again. And so it's not just about Jewish exile. It's ultimately about this quintessential struggle between God and man with a righteous remnant, Daniel and his friends hanging out in the middle of the beast, so to speak. Yes, ma'am, go ahead.
This isn't his first encounter with God.
Correct.
And I think that has a lot to do with his punishment because
he's
watched Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, and so he knows that there is something greater than himself. And yet when he gets to this point, look what I did, and he should know better.
Yeah, well, and he was warned too. Actually, go back to early chapter 4 for a second. I'm going to look at that. Daniel warned him because he had a dream again. And God, but yeah, his whole, he's saying, the thing that people sometimes miss about Nebuchadnezzar when you read the book of Daniel too casually, is he says all the right things in the aftermath of those episodes, but you don't go by what people say, you go by what people do. And so he'll say, but he's a polytheist, so he's going to say nice because he doesn't, well, part of what he doesn't seem to get is, you know, I can say nice things about one God while still doing what I want. And if you've never made the connection, the statue, the golden image that Daniel's friends are commanded to bow down to, comes right out of the dream in which there was an image of multiple metals, but what metal was Nebuchadnezzar?
The golden image.
Yeah, and what was the message of that dream in chapter 2? Your kingdom will not. Your kingdom's not going to last. So if you're Nebuchadnezzar, what you want your kingdom to last, what do you need to do?
Make it all gold.
Make it all gold and see who's going to bow down and who won't as a loyalty test. Find the traitors, find the weak links. So rather than submitting to God's control of history, which is what chapter 4 is about, I raise up and put in charge who I want. Nebuchadnezzar says, thanks for the heads up, thanks for the warning, but I think I'll find my own way around this dilemma. Now that I know there's a weak spot, I'll go looking for the traitors. Who will bow down to the golden image, and, you know, representing me, my kingdom, now that, you know. Yeah, the trick with Anthem is we don't read the stories all the way across. We read them, again, PBS style. Nothing wrong with that, but you're not five anymore. So, anyways. By the way, to Vicky's point, too, just like Nebuchadnezzar knew by this point in the story, chapter 5, and by the way, the power of the way the story works, too, again, reading all the way across. Here's Nebuchadnezzar with his great ego. He's built, and in human terms, he has built this great city and this great empire. But, you know, when he gets his comeuppance here in chapter 4, you turn the page to chapter 5, and where's Nebuchadnezzar? This is not a trick question. I think I heard somebody say it.
Yeah.
He's dead. He's gone. In fact, I didn't even get a funeral. He's just gone. Teach us to number our days, and we may have a heart of wisdom. He's gone. And not only is he gone, but his big, beautiful city. It's not just that we're now in Belshazzar's reign, but where are we at in Babylon's history as you turn the page of chapter 5? Literally, it's last hours even, because that very night Belshazzar is slain. It literally, you see, you turn the page, you go to Nebuchadnezzar, not just Nebuchadnezzar gone, but it's Babylon's last hours. So much for human boasting. What's the message of that when you read again? You're reading long ways across. What's the message there? What's God saying? He laughs at human arrogance. He laughs at human arrogance. But to Vicky's point, by the way, part of why Belshazzar is in such big trouble with God. Look at me real quick, chapter 5, and then we'll move on to some other stuff. Chapter 5. When Daniel is brought in to help Belshazzar figure out about the handwriting on the wall, little details often overmissed. Or overlooked. I can't talk today. Overmissed. That's not quintessential, Randy. Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, languages trembled and feared before him. By the way, that's Babel language. All nations, peoples, and languages. You don't have to tell the story the way it is. It's told the way it is for a reason. Where did languages come from? Babel. What is Babylon now? A gathering under the imperial power of Babylon of nations, peoples, and languages again. How the story is told matters. So anyways, but Daniel's pointing this all out to him. But when that verse 20, Nebuchadnezzar's heart was lifted up, his spirit hardened so that he dealt proudly. Oh, there's our word. He was brought down from his kingly throne, glory taken from him, driven among the children from among the children of mankind. His mind was made like that of a beast. And his dwelling was with wild donkeys. Verse 22, though. You, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart. And here's the phrase that brought us here. Though you what? You knew all this too. And yet what are you doing? You're partying like it's 1999 is what you're doing. And by the way, early in the chapter, he's brought out God's stuff from the temple that they had in their treasuries intentionally to toast his own gods with. So the gods whose stuff he's using in his pagan orgy or whatever's going on there that night, the God whose cups those are, has something to say about what's going on. And again, the most frightening and damning line in the whole thing is, you did this. And what did you do anyways? Human pride. Human pride. And by the way, from a little bit of a different version than I expected, but Romans 1, for all its familiarity, draw a line. Bible's just 20 big ideas. It's like theme and variation in the symphony, right? You know, just a handful of ideas that just keep on appearing over and over again, different language, but if you get an ear for it, same basic concept. Romans chapter 1, for all its familiarity. Verse 19 of Romans chapter 1, for what can be known about God is plain to them, mankind, because God has shown it to him. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without
excuse.
Draw a line from Daniel 5 there. Though you knew this. You may not know exactly the nature of God and what he wants, but can you know he's there by looking at creation? You realize that you have to learn to look at the heavens, or you have to learn to look at animals and see evolution. Yeah, that's an intentionally learned thing. I mean, ask a kid, you take them to the museum, ask a kid how birds became dinosaurs. The kid will look at you and say, that's silly. Because a five-year-old can laugh at that. But you can go get a PhD. In fact, it takes a PhD to have to be able to see it that way, I think, sometimes. You have to become kind of a certain amount of learned ignorance. So anyways, all right, that's enough about that. So all we start from just a strong word about human contingency, and this is the quintessential human struggle between collectively man and God, mankind and God, but also between every one of us. Because who among us has never struggled with pride? Either in some seemingly smaller way where we just kind of look down on others, or maybe in some moments or seasons of sin in our lives where, if we're honest, the reason we were bold enough to sin and not fear is because we lost the fear of God, which is a species of pride. It's always pride, rightly understood, all the way down at the bottom of the ball. Does that make sense? Anybody want to know that real quick before we switch gears a little bit? Take it another direction, a little bit different. Is that a hand or a scratch? My glasses are back on, so I don't do it. All right. So, one of the strongest books in the Bible, you're looking for like one-stop shopping that just drives home what it means to be human, is the book of Ecclesiastes. In a lot of ways, Ecclesiastes is a subtle commentary, and it's easier to see, this is cheating for me to say this, I shouldn't be saying this, but I'm reckless tonight because I'm tired. It's easier to see when you read it in the original than sometimes in English, because it's a tough book to translate in English. Not that your English translations are no good, but some of these words, kind of translate poetry from one language to another, then those work well, you lose a little bit. You can certainly get the basic point. But it's even easier to see that in a lot of ways Ecclesiastes is a commentary on Genesis 3 and 4. And the nature of life under the sun is man without God, living by sin. But again, what's the issue? Genesis 3, you can be like God, and then instead what we do is we unleash sin and death. And so, for all its familiarity, a couple things about Ecclesiastes. Spend a few minutes in Ecclesiastes here, and then we'll switch gears again. It's a profound book. And just start with me in chapter 1. We'll kind of surf and survey through here for a couple minutes. The classic understanding of the preacher's great refrain, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, is what? What's the classic, you know, for most of us that we grew up with, me included, what's the classic sense of what the preacher's saying, vanity of vanities? Life is?
Worthless.
Mirthless, or another word?
Fleeting.
Yeah, that's actually correct. That's very much part of it. What else though?
Meaningless.
Meaningless, yeah, kind of the classic understanding. And that's true, that's good, that's as far as it goes, that works. But it's not ultimately the robust sense of what's going on. And it becomes a little bit easier to see in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, at the very beginning, where the refrain first hits. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. The word itself is literally a noun, vanity, hevel in Hebrew, that literally means of like a vapor or a mist. Now, that word works metaphorically in a lot of ways, because a vapor or a mist is something that has no real
substance.
I remember when I was a kid, first time I kind of flew through a cloud in an airplane, I was expecting, to see if they're leprechauns or something, I don't know. And all you find out is really the cloud is
nothing.
It looks like something, but it's nothing. Same thing, I remember when I was a kid, you know, you see fog, a foggy morning. Remember, wake up a kid in a foggy morning, and you try to chase the fog. How does that work out for you? You keep running, but you never quite get there, okay? A vapor, a mist. So there's certainly a sense in which there is no substance to it, thus maybe metaphorically meaningless. But in this book, and we'll see this in just a second, we'll actually look at what he does with it here in chapter 1. It goes a step further. A cloud, a mist, or a vapor doesn't last. In fact, that's why elsewhere in the Bible, the morning dew or the morning fog is a metaphor for, you know, what happens when the sun hits the fog?
It dissipates
rapidly. Won't even last till lunchtime. And the second thing is, you don't control it. You don't control it. You have no control over it. Watch how this works in chapter 1. Understand that. So, go back a step. Make clear that. So no control over something. You know, it's there, it is what it is, and doesn't last. And sometimes, there are a few passages of Ecclesiastes, to be fair, that does bring up the sense of meaningless. But the larger sense that we often miss, you don't have control of it. That doesn't last. Okay? So go with me, chapter 1. Drop down a little bit with me here in chapter 1. And I want to pick up one of the other famous phrases that he uses that helps us see this a little bit more clearly. Start in for sake of time, verse 14. I have seen everything's done under the sun, and behold, all is, there's our word, but he gives the next one, and is a, say again?
Strives after wind.
Yeah, striving after wind. They have translation. In fact, the translation may vary a little bit. I'm sorry, what'd you say here?
Vexation of spirit.
Vexation. Oh. Interesting. Okay. Literally in Hebrew, the word there is shepherding the wind. So not just, so there is a sense in which shepherding is a striving work. You ever watch a shepherd with a recalcitrant flock? There is a struggle sometimes, but ultimately the real idea is shepherding the wind. Now that's an interesting way to actually phrase it, to shepherd the wind. The better phrase we might use today from our culture, herding cats. You ever heard that? You ever heard that one? And some of you are laughing already. Why is that? Maybe get a little bit closer to home. Why are we talking about herding cats?
I don't listen.
Because you can't do it. Some of y'all of a certain age, I love this commercial. It's really old now, but Ross Perot's dead. But you remember his company, EDS. And by the way, the mark of a really great commercial is you love the commercial, but you can't remember who it was for. I had to go look it up. EDS. And by the way, if you go look on YouTube, especially those of you who are younger, this is new because it's like 15, 20 years ago now. Go look on YouTube. It's a hilarious commercial. You know what I'm talking about, Dan? You remember this one now? Yeah, because you knew it was EDS. Tech guy would. but it was a hilarious commercial with a bunch of cowboys, you know, and they're all, you know, kind of rough and leathered up, you know, and they got scars and stuff. And some of you know that now. Remember the commercial? Great commercial. I'm sorry, you got need to go on YouTube. Nice.
I've
you,
seen it. Oh, it's good.
Why am I wasting my time? Moving on. No, but anyways, you know, cowboys, you know, you think they're herding cattle, but they're herding cats. You know, and there's several versions of it. There's some longer versions, some shorter versions, a couple different versions because they ran a couple different times. You know, my favorite line is when some old grizzled cowboy, he's tan as the dirt, you know, and he's listing his scratches, you know, the, oh, short hair got me here, and, you know, one guy at one point says something like, you know, no, no better feeling in the world than bringing a herd of short hairs into town. But no, but the best is some old guy sitting by a campfire, I'm living a dream. And it's great. See, you should go watch it. Anyways, herding cats. And of course, by the way, there was a powerful little commercial metaphor because the whole idea was EDS. You know, anybody who works in tech knows databases, corralling formats, everything else. So EDS will help you do the impossible, herd all your data into, you know, some secure and controllable place. Same kind of idea here at the end of the day. You don't shepherd the wind. You don't shepherd the wind. You don't have control over it, right? Wind, and it works really well because wind itself, you know, there's no substance to it, yet you feel it. And no physicists sitting here. We don't talk about it. It's just a thing of matter, Jeff. And yes, technically, there are facts. You know, I know. I went to code school, too. But how you live life, there's no substance to it. But you feel it. It has effects on you, but you have no feeling. You don't see it. There's no substance. It's here and it's gone. It's a breeze and it's gone, and you have no control over it. And here's the other part that why this, especially in light of Ecclesiastes, one of the big themes of Ecclesiastes that I'll mention in just a sec. One of the other great things about it too is you don't really understand or comprehend it. You know it's there, you feel it, you see its effects, but you don't understand it. Where does the wind begin and end?
I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It's just there. You know, the forecaster may say, oh, we have strong winds tonight. Good. What county are they going to start in? See how it works? You know it, you have the experience, it's there, but you have no actual complete knowledge of the thing. Tell me where the wind begins and ends. Right? Okay. So yeah, so you don't shepherd the wind. It's all vanity. It's a, you know, all is unknowable and uncontrollable in the end. And so, you know, you begin to understand that. And you know, verse 17 is, so I applied my heart to know wisdom and know madness and folly, and I perceive that this is all but a striving after the wind. You can't do that. You're not going to know. You're not going to understand. What do we want to do? What, especially in a scientific age that we live in now, what do we want?
Understand.
What's Elon Musk want? Besides getting to Mars.
Control.
He wants control. That's what it's about. That's exactly right. He wants a certain kind of control over reality and our human limits. And so just to kind of quickly begin serving, go to chapter 2, verse 12. So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do? And by the way, when you're in Ecclesiastes, look how often words like what or who knows, those kind of phrases appear. It's all over the book. That's the whole point. I have no control and I don't really know, though I'm trying to know. Limits of being human. And in Genesis 3 and 4 world. What can the man do who comes after the king? Only what's been done. I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than the folly, so it's relatively better. There's more gain in light than in darkness. And yet, verse 14, second half, yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. At the end of the day, whether you're wise or foolish, what still happens to you once you hit your 80th birthday or, you know, 85, yeah, whatever? You're still just as dead, right? So what was the point of really being wise ultimately? It says there's a rope, you know, it'll save you some sorrow and some tears while you're living, but at the end of the day, the biggest idiot you've ever known, the biggest fool, the biggest arrogant person versus the most godly person, what's going to happen 100 years from now? We're in both of them. So really, and that's why later in the book he'll say, so don't be overly wise and overly righteous. He's not literally saying, so a little sin's good for you. What he's getting at is if you think that being righteous or being wise will exempt you from or give you the control that we really want, especially in the day of death, righteousness and wisdom are actually no antidote to that either, because it's still about God and you are not God. Right? That's kind of the basic idea. So what's interesting is chapter 2, look at the end of chapter 2. This refrain occurs several times throughout the book, in chapter 5, chapter 9. It's kind of a concept. So what do you do? You know, rather than just sit around and be frustrated, you know, look into the abyss on the internet at night and give into despair. No. Verse 24, there is nothing better, and by the way, in Hebrew, good, the same word from Genesis, tov. Here's what good is, just like back in the garden. Here's what tov is. Here's what good is. Here's what the good is, that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. That's not like a Genesis 2 kind of thing.
Here's
you say again?
That's the curse.
But ultimately, take what the good that God gives you. All you can eat buffet is Genesis chapter 2, right? And do your work, you know, your toil, have your dominion. Of course, ironically, the Hebrew that's used there now is it's a more strenuous toil. It's a Genesis 3 toil. But the idea was simply receive what God has given you to enjoy and do whatever task God has placed before you in life providentially and leave the rest of it alone. That's what's tov for you now. Don't try to unlock the mysteries of the universe. This I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, apart from God, who can eat or have enjoyment really? For to the one who pleases God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he's given the business of gathering and collecting. Only to the one who pleases God, this also is vanity and striving after the wind. This is the way it is. You can't control this. This is how it works. Better to enjoy the goodness that God has left in the world for you to have on his terms, rather than striving to control that which is not yours to control, and to understand that which is not for you to know. Make sense? All right. Book is just rife with that, over and over and over again. That kind of thing. Chapter 3, we won't go through the full list, I can't. Chapter 3, you know, look at verse 12. I perceive that there is nothing better for them to be joyful and do good as long as they live. Also, everyone should eat and drink and take his pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. What's the difference between a gift and a wage?
One's earned, one is
wage earned.
Yeah. You find the joy in life by receiving as God's gift, not something I take. Which means, you know, part of wisdom is knowing when to quit working for more money. When is enough enough? You with me? I mean, just sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes it's not just you've got a glass ceiling, you know, at work. Sometimes maybe in God's providence in your life, there's a ceiling. God does not want you wasting any more time in this, you know, whatever endeavor, spending more time in it. Sometimes you just got to know when to just sit back and enjoy what we've been given providentially. And so there it is. I perceive there's nothing better. Verse 14, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever, unlike the Babylons of life. Nothing can be added to it nor taken away from it. At the end of the day, if God shows you a vision, I'm saying we have visions, mate, work with me. But if God shows you a vision in which there's gold, silver, bronze, and iron, what's it going to be? Regardless of whether you want to build an all-gold statue, what's it going to be? It's going to be gold, silver, bronze. You with me? And that's what he's saying. Nothing, you know, this is what God's going to do. Nothing's going to add or take from that. God has done it so that people should, this is a verb that's a cousin of humility. God says, so you'll fear him. You'll have respect for him. You'll understand he's God, you're not. That's why it's set up this way. Basically, God has set up the cursed world in a way that's supposed to drag you back to him, not make you more arrogant, and you're absolutely going to build your sandcastle in defiance of his tides of time. That's the truth. For sake of time, chapter 6. For whatever has been, has already been named. That's Babel language, back to Genesis again. God does the naming of some things. You're not going to change their natures or what they are. God is named. Man is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. What advantage to man? For who knows what is good? Tov. What is good? Genesis. For man, while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow. Just lack of substance, lack of length. For who can tell me what will be after him under the sun? You don't know what's really good. God alone knows what's good for you to do with your time. Just over and over. Maybe last place. Just one more. Let's just leave it there. You get the point. By the way, that helps you learn a little bit more why chapter 12, what's the book actually ends. You can read the book all the way through, not just kind of the excerpts that we tend to read. Makes more sense why in chapter 12, famously, the book ends with advice to young people to do what?
Fear God.
Fear God, but even before that, the beginning of that's at the end of chapter. Say again?
Enjoy the Kriya.
Enjoy the Kriya. But you'll notice, and again, notice the word. God is never called Yahweh in this book. It's his covenantal name in the Old Testament. You know, he's never called Redeemer. He's only called Creator. It's a Genesis book. He's only called the Creator. And so remember the Creator. And you know, go back to the right relationship. What is mankind before God? Go back to a Genesis understanding of who you really are. That's the road to whatever pleasure is left to be found, whatever happiness, whatever satisfaction, whatever peace, can still be found in a fallen world. That's where it is. So young people, as soon as you figure it out, and by the help of such a little bit more, the other part of that verse I'll go up and skip. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Better to start building your life that way from the beginning before the Eagle, they said. And we hear that word morally, but in Hebrew, that's not the sense, because that same word evil can mean moral evil, but also just simply mean bad times. Because what's going to happen if you live long enough, not to be ugly tonight or kind of down on Mother's Day, but what's going to happen if you live long enough in life?
You'll have tough times.
You're going to get run over. You're going to get run over. And so it's better to start now. And by the way, if you remember your creator, remember that he's God, you're not, what are you going to realize? I don't have some control over this. I think one of the biggest frustrations for people, especially when you're young, going through life, is you have these expectations, a little more easier in our kind of culture especially, you have the expectation that if I play by the rules, what's going to happen?
Good things are going to happen.
Then I have a certain measure of control over my life, and I can make sure that things are always going to be good. Good for me, good for my marriage, good for my kids, good financially, good, you know, good, feeling good, however you want. And the preacher says, don't do that. In fact, I remind, that's actually my last place in Let's Book. Go back to chapter 5. This is the other one that actually is a nice segue to the one other part that's more easily forgotten. These verses seem a little weird until, again, you think about them in the larger flow of the book. Chapter 5. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. So stop right there. Anybody want to take a stab at what's going on, especially in the comments of the book, I think what we're talking about? What's going on here? I thought God wants me to praise. Why is he telling me to watch my mouth when I go to the temple? And especially, what in the world is verse 3 have to do with that?
Well, we shouldn't make rash promises to God.
Yeah, it's going to be the second paragraph, starting verse 4 in particular. That's right. This isn't about worship. What was Hannah doing at the tabernacle? Beginning of 1 Samuel, what was Hannah there to do?
Pray,
but there was a very specific angle to her prayer. What was her prayer about? And well, she wasn't just asking. There's another word we need to use. In fact, it's in the second paragraph, verses 4 through 6.
Vowing.
Yeah, there it is. Why do you make vows? Why did people in the Old Testament make vows? I know some people that think who make vows to God. They don't talk about that much publicly, but I know some people told me, you know, privately that they have something going on in their heart to make a vow to God about something. What's the nature of a vow? Especially in the Old Testament, what's the nature of a vow? Why do you do it? What are you trying to accomplish?
You get what you want, but you have to give up something that matters to you.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry.
Ensure commitment.
Ensure commitment from who, though?
You're from yourself.
Well, from yourself, but what's the condition of your commitment in theory?
He fulfills his end.
So you're trying to get, you're trying to even more strongly than just a typical prayer of petition. You're trying to get God to give you what you want.
Covenant.
It's interesting, the Bible never uses that word, but we're getting close to it. Mm-hmm. In fact, the second paragraph here, verses 4 through 6, I'll read in just a second. I mean, that's the whole point, though, is at the end of the day, once you're in on it, especially if God holds up his end, whatever you were vowing, you'd better not back out, man. Okay? But part of the happens, I mean, you know, think about, Hannah, in this case, this isn't, I'm going to give up chewing gum if God gives me what I want. Think about Hannah, we use her as an example. What did she offer to God in return if God gave her a child?
She gave the child.
She turned around and gives the child right back. That's more than just saying, I'm going to give up chewing gum for a year. Pretty big. Pretty big. But at the end of the day, why would people make vows? To even more strongly try to get God to do what? Give me what I want or think I need. Now here's the thing. What's the spiritual danger in that? Think about this.
God is able to deliver. Are you?
Maybe. That says more about your dark heart. No, that's Maybe.
It feels as if you're almost challenging God.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yes. We're getting closer to the...
That's what I think. I mean, you're making a deal. You're trying to make a deal with God.
Okay. So here's the thing. Like so many things in life spiritually, it's acceptable to God, but you have to guard your heart and your mind when you're doing this? Yeah, you do. Because this can almost become the attempt to manipulate God, quid pro quo. We're used to talking about today, it's all about the art of the deal. And so I'm going to get what I need from God or what I want from God, and I'll try to get as much from God as I can, and hopefully as least the price as possible. But the whole idea is, and then you get to the second part, the second paragraph, verses 4 through 6, and even more treacherously, sometimes what happens? When you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for God has no pleasure to fools. Do not delay in paying it. It is better that you should not vow that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger. Weird concept, but probably the idea is when you vows you were typically made publicly. I mean, did Eli know what Hannah had done? Yeah. Yeah, he did, because they talked about it. And so vows often have a public component of it. The Book of Psalms hits it that morning. It's another class, another quarter. And so, you know, when the temple messenger, so to speak, comes up to say, okay, you know, God's delivered for you, time to whatever you vowed, it's time to, you know, give that in dedication to God, because it's God's now, whatever you and God vowed. You know, when the messenger shows up, you don't say it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase, words grow many, and there is vanity, but one God you must fear. And so we're back to this dream thing again, like in verse 3. So a couple things going on here. Again, the temptation to try to use vowing as manipulating God, especially when you back out of whatever commitment you made when the bill comes due. If God does actually, you know. But by the way, sometimes people vow and not get what they vow. Yeah, because God will not ultimately manipulate it. But in the context of this book, a book about how humans want to know and the control. The controlling hanging around here, where now you at least know enough to know that God's the one you got to deal with. But you're trying to put God to work for you, rather than realizing that your life is contingent before God, and there's a real spiritual danger there. Make sense? The other part, what about the dreams? Dreams come with much effort. And it comes back to dreams, verse 6. Well, what was one of the common ways that people find out about, like, especially in the Old Testament, the future? Yeah. And so, and was this a time in which God would sometimes give dreams? We'll talk about today, we'll talk about then, yeah. And so you think sometimes, you know, a dream comes with much effort, you think people really want to know the future sometimes. Because if I know the future, what can I do today?
Control.
You know, if I know exactly what the stock market is going to do every day this week, I'll be financially independent by Friday. Maybe not, but you get the idea. If I had that kind of control, if I know exactly when my lifestyle is going to cause me cancer or heart disease, man. If I knew exactly when I was going to die, you're not going to stop that. If I knew exactly, would that affect it? So also, it means that I'm not going to die. If I'm not going to die skydiving, guess what I'm doing this week? Nah, I'm just kidding. I still would do it. But you get the point. If I knew that there was no real risk today because I'm not going to die until I'm 88, I might go back to eating fried foods. Why not? Yeah, Jerry.
It's rare that anyone who received dreams were happy about it.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing, too.
It's heavy. I mean, going back to Hannah and Samuel, like, he received a dream. He didn't want to tell Eli about it.
Yeah, bad news. Yeah, it's kind of funny. Yeah, in fact, when I have a sermon I preach on Daniel 5 and that, but, you know, with Belshazzar, it's kind of interesting. How did, you know, Belshazzar doesn't know what it means, but, you know, why does he just immediately assume it's bad? Remember, you know, his knees knock and his bowels are loose, depending on your translation. He's scared to death about what this is. How do you know it's not good news? How do you know it's not this God's saying, hey, good news, we're going to deliver you tonight?
Because it wasn't just a dream in the night. He knew something was happening.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, so that makes sense. Last thing about Ecclesiastes then, boy, there goes time for today. But even there, don't even try to manipulate or control God, even with legitimate religious things. That makes sense. Spiritual danger in that. God is God, and we are not. All right. Any other comments or questions before we switch gears again? Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
It's a fool's thought that you're not really manipulating God.
But it is a fool's thought. But you're right.
You're bringing. You've lost the respect, and you're trying to bring him down to your level as though he was part of creation.
Yeah.
To make a deal.
Yeah.
When in reality.
Yeah.
It's a joke.
Yeah. That's right. And that's what the preacher's trying to get us to understand in this book. Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. So, is that Adrian, yes.
But God has told us the future. He told us the end, right?
Yeah.
He's told us, and he's given that to us, so that way we could plan for it.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing he wants us to plan for.
But ironically, I agree with that, but the irony is, he's told us what it will be, but what's the thing that he hasn't told us that still leaves us out of control in the sense that bugs us all, let's be honest. We all agree. That's the catch, isn't it? So I still, because listen, if I know he's not coming back until next week, what can I do this week?
Live it up.
I wouldn't. No. Yeah, but you get the point, right? You know, because that's what we are. That's what we would do. If we're honest, you're all just more honest than I am. But anyways, but yeah, so yeah, we know what. But still, lest you have a sense of control, heaven forbid you try to manipulate God with the knowledge, he still won't tell you when. So, all right. Another hand before you switch gears with the last couple minutes. All right, let's switch gears again. Different aspect of human limitation. You know, for sake of time, I want to kind of go to kind of the big close here. Go through the Isaiah chapter 40. We don't have much time left. Isaiah chapter 40. Kind of hit a few things through Isaiah. Get into one of those big ideas. Sometimes what we need is simply to be confronted with God's self-revelation of the distance between us and him. You know, too often we come to the Bible wanting just to be told what we do to be saved. It's like, you know, just give me the rules, give me the list, give me the bare list of requirements, give me the minimum graduation requirements. You know, I'm not trying to graduate summa cum laude of valedictorian. Just tell me the bare essentials to get across the goal line, right? But the problem is, when you have that mentality, not only is that not going to spiritual maturity, but that mentality itself already tends to trivialize God. And go back to what this class is about, in our human nature, because I'm not made to barely qualify. I am made to bear his image. And so sometimes we need to come back to the Bible and say, what do I need to be reading right now? Not just, you know, more moral passages about, you know, that kind of stuff, but there's nothing wrong with that. We need to just spend some time in passages that have nothing else but just simply the slapping in the face with the enormity of the God we're dealing with here, right? You know, we don't get visions today. There's going to be no angel coming tonight just to put you back in your place, which, you know, might do us some good, some of us, me included. That's not going to happen, but where can I access and experience anytime I think I need it? And maybe even more often, because I don't realize how much I need it. The records of those who did have those slapped in the face experiences, when God either verbally or in a dream or in some way slaps them in the face. And so here comes God in Isaiah's day, in Isaiah chapter 40. And let's pick up in verse 17. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. You don't even have a word for how much these are nothing to God. Well, I didn't get very far either there. So next time you're watching the United Nations, next time you're watching, you know, I don't care, you know, which party, doesn't matter, because this is about God over all of it. Next time you're watching some Secretary of State or a bunch of professional diplomats from the State Department stressing over or feeling so important. How many of you are old enough to remember, which probably isn't many, but how many maybe from your history, remember Henry Kissinger?
Yes.
How big a deal was he back in the day? How big a deal was he?
He was an oracle, man.
He was an oracle. And he was Secretary of State and was, you know, supposedly this, you know, great, you know, diplomatic genius. Well, first of all, did he bring world peace? No. Some of you heard me tell the story before. I remember, we'll just end with this to drive home that point. Because we do tend to get too emotionally invested in politics these days and forget it's all nothing before God. I remember a few years ago, we took a family trip out to Fredericksburg, went to the LBJ ranch. Some of y'all have been out there, done that. And it's fun, it's cool, it's pretty neat to see all that. And it was really interesting because some of the old, like, Secret Service shacks are still there, you know, and you kind of realize, you know, I'm walking on ground that if I got anywhere close, I would have been shot dead, you know, 40 years ago. And now I'm sitting around there throwing acorns with my kids. But what really was profound was this. You remember, some of you remember, again, depending on how old you are or how much you remember your history, LBJ had the Spare Rib Summit out there. Remember, brought a bunch of European leaders, like the German chancellor came out, brought them all out to the ranch. You know, and they served a barbecue because it's Texas, man. And what was really fascinating was looking at one of the displays, you know, they did it out in front of the house on the banks of the Pedernales there. And looking at those pictures that they had in the montage there as you were going through. And of course, oak trees last a really long time. And so what really was stunning was to look at the pictures of here are these world leaders and the President of the United States walking around among these oak trees, and then look past the pictures of the display, and they're the same oak trees now. But 40 years ago, when that was going on, the most powerful people, humanly speaking, on the planet are gathered in those trees. And now here am I walking around, and where are all those people in those pictures today?
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, LBJ's grave is about half a mile back over from those trees. And I couldn't get anywhere near him back then. I could walk, you know, within, you know, up to the fence line, you know, about 5 feet from his grave today. They are less than nothing to God. Let the reader understand. All right.
It would be 60 years.
Oh, you're right. That's why I switched majors, Vicki.